the stream of fighters going into Afghanistan from Pakistan, being trained in Pakistan, being funded in Pakistan, and then going into fight. So I wanted to document all that. And in the middle of that story, I was in a refugee camp just outside of Peshawar. I was actually heading back to my hotel. I thought, okay, it's about 11 o'clock in the morning. Go back. And I just walked past this school. It was in a tent. And I heard these voices, these girls reciting something. I thought, okay, well, maybe on my way back, I'll just stop in and check this out. So I go into the tent, and there's all these girls and the teacher. And before I even asked permission from the teacher if I could photograph, I saw this one little girl with this incredible expression, this face, these incredible eyes.
Those eyes belonged to the refugee Shahbat Gula. Hers would become one of the most widely recognized faces in the world after Steve McCurry's portrait of her, Afghan Girl, was featured on the cover of National Geographic magazine in 1985. By that time, McCurry was already an established photographer. In 1978, he quit his job at a Pennsylvania newspaper and bought a one-way ticket to India. So began a career of almost constant travel, with McCurry capturing some of the most vivid and enduring images of Asia and the Middle East along the way. His pictures of people affected by conflict brought him international acclaim, but McCurry has willfully defied categorization. He's photographed as many Buddhists as soldiers, and combined uncompromising photojournalism with personal projects and Pirelli calendar shoots. Last year, his willful fluidity led to an image-altering controversy. It threw up questions about the ethics of photography in a world of increasing technological complexity. It would be easy for McCurry to hang up his camera and rest on his laurels, but he continues to travel around the world taking photos with his partner and young daughter. And I'm pleased to say Steve McCurry joins me today in Lisbon for the big interview. Thank you for joining me for the big interview. So in 1978, you quit your job as a newspaper photographer and bought a one-way ticket to India with some film in your bag and very little else. Help me understand how you got to the point in your life where you made that decision.
Well, the way I developed this passion, this sort of obsession with travel was, oddly enough, I was working in a mailroom after high school. I was working in the international division of this company. I wasn't really aware of the outside world beyond, you know, Newtown Square, Pennsylvania. But all these people started coming into the office from Turkey and from Honduras and India. And I got this sort of fascination with all these foreigners which were coming in, and I was meeting them every day. So I decided, okay, you know, I wanted to travel. So I saved a bit of money. And I decided to go live in Europe for a year. Worked in Sweden as a kind of a dishwasher. Went to Amsterdam. Then we drove with a couple of friends to Istanbul. We went down to Israel. And at this time, everybody was going to Israel and working on the kibbutz because it was a way to, you know, live for free and to experience other culture. So this year in Europe really got me hooked on travel. I decided that, you know, whatever I did with my life, I want to travel to play a part. So I went back to school, went to college, and for two or three years, I was sort of kind of aimless, didn't really know what I wanted to do. And then another summer, I went to Africa with some friends, went back to school, and I thought, you know what? I've always enjoyed films. I've always loved cinema. I thought, okay, I'll study film. So I signed up in my third year of college. There was, I only had one and a half years left to go. And I signed up for this film course. In the middle of studying cinematography, I took a directing class, I took a set design class, theater arts, and one of the requirements was photography, still photography. So borrowed a camera from the school, went out, and then suddenly my whole world kind of opened up. I literally fell in love with the still camera. It was easier. It was more immediate. There wasn't any kind of pre-production or post-production. I could literally walk out the door of my apartment and just shoot anything. And there was no script. It was all sort of serendipitous moments. So I had this kind of crossroads. Do I become a filmmaker? Do I become a photographer? when I graduated, I said, okay, whatever job I get first, that's the direction I'm going to go in. So I applied for jobs as a filmmaker, as a camera operator, as a photographer in a newspaper and whatever, and sent out hundreds of resumes. And the first thing that really came my way was a job on a newspaper. And I thought, okay, well, there you have it. Going to be a photographer.
Tell me about the newspaper. What newspaper was it? And what did you do when you arrived there?
Well, I was thrilled to have this job because suddenly I was being paid to take pictures. That was my, you know, real goal. But it was a community suburban newspaper, and the assignments were, you know, the Women's Club, the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club, there are all these service clubs, the Chamber of Commerce, Little League, high school sports, graduations. And the first year it was sort of okay, but then it became very repetitive. And I thought, you know, I have to escape. My whole dream, the ambition was to travel. And here I am in this really boring job. And I wasn't able to go to a better newspaper. So the only way to kind of break out was to just sort of put everything on the line, take the big risk, sell the car, you know, leave the apartment, and go to India. And the reason India was because I had already been to Europe. I had spent some time in Latin America, Central America, been to Africa. And I thought, okay, well, I want to launch this freelance career in a new place. So, you know, China was difficult in 78. Soviet Union was difficult, so the logical choice was to go to Asia, to go to South Asia, go to India. Actually, it was the best choice I ever made because India is so rich and full of culture and stories. And I, you know, the heavy rain, the monsoon was like, wow, this is incredible. You know, flooding or drought, life or death. I mean, farmers were literally hanging in the balance. Their livelihood if it was rained too much or not enough. So I wandered around India looking for stories.
And this all happened, the monsoon, the trains, this all happened in your first trip.
First
out
year,
there.
Yeah.
When you arrived out there, did you know what you wanted to shoot? Did you have an idea?
Well, my first trip to India was only scheduled for like 6 weeks. I was going to go there, do a few things, and then I was going to jump over to the Mediterranean. I thought, okay, what the stories I envisioned to do in India, I thought I can do the whole thing in 6 weeks, and then I'm going to go do a Mediterranean tour. Well, that 6 weeks turned into 2 years. One story, another story. I went up to the Himalayas, and then went to Goa, went to Bombay and Calcutta. I was just bombarded with all this incredible visual stuff that I just literally was so fascinated in that it just kind of kept going and going.
And were you figuring it out mainly as you went along, or you know, what had you learned from your time in the provincial newspaper that you could apply in that radically different kind of social and geographical setting?
Well, I think the only thing that really helped me, having worked for the newspaper, was to go into a situation and quickly sum it up and to be able to come up with a picture in a few minutes. The kind of the aesthetic and the way of working for a newspaper is very different. The whole sensibility of kind of a news picture and rush in and get the picture was very different from working for magazines or making sort of pictures for myself, just wandering around and photographing things which maybe don't tell a story, maybe, but don't really have any news value. You know, people talking on a street corner doesn't really have any value for a newspaper, but in terms of exploring the human condition and how we live our lives in this world, that's my calling, to tell these little human stories about how we relate to the environment, how we relate to animals, how we relate to each other, people sleeping, people eating, people playing, children. And that's what I'd love to walk around, just catch these moments of people living their lives.
Tell me about the next trip that you went on, because it was to another very different context, wasn't it? It was to Afghanistan.
Afghanistan was really the turning point in not only my career, but my life. It was in June of 1979. That's when I first tripped. Subsequently, I made about 30 trips into Afghanistan for various reasons, sometimes for myself, sometimes it was for a magazine, sometimes for a book. Well, the first two trips, which were very pivotal, were on my own. Nobody sent me. I just went there on my own without any communication with any magazine or newspaper. It was just literally just go try and document what was happening.
Why did you make that decision? When you could have made the decision at that point just to go and document another exotic land in a similar way to the way in which you shot India. And indeed, you did go on to do those kinds of projects later in your career and to combine it with your conflict reporting. What was driving you at that moment in time to put yourself in a position of a very considerable danger?
You know, I went to this area of Pakistan, up in the mountains, up in the Hindu Kush. It was very beautiful, looked like Aspen, Colorado. There were two Afghans living in my hotel. We got to chatting and they said, you know, there's this war raging literally over this next mountain range here. Thousands of people have been bombed, their villages destroyed, and they're now living here as refugees. And they said, we want, you know, you're a photographer. Nobody seems to be telling this story. Why don't we want to invite you in and show the world what's happening. You know, having been on a newspaper, I understood the news value of this story. And it was a beautiful area. It seemed like this was an incredible opportunity. I didn't really think it through so deeply. And as the next hours passed, I realized, well, this is a war zone, and they're asking me to go into another country, basically illegally without a passport. You know, if I got captured or whatever, there was no phones, there was no running water, there was no any kind of communication or transportation. Everything was by foot or by horseback. I thought, you know, this, I was kind of brash and kind of, this is a great opportunity. It seemed like a great adventure. It seemed like an important story to tell. And I just decided, you know, I got to do this. There are times in your life when you just have to take risks. And I thought this is one of those occasions. I didn't know what to expect, but I thought, I have to do this. And I just decided to go. It was one of the most grueling, difficult trips of my life. We would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, walk all day long. There was gunfire and bombing and people were being killed. But it was as time went on, I just sort of got sucked into it and I just had to stay and document this thing. And then subsequently go back again a few weeks later. And then I just started going several times a year. And then probably average out to almost every year I've been going to Afghanistan.
And there's an interesting story in there as to how you got over the border in the first place, and indeed how you got out.
Well, you know, after all that time, and I was kind of sick, I was tired, I wasn't feeling that well, and I'd risked my life. I thought, you know what, if I get stopped by the border police, I'm going to organize my exposed film and kind of hide it within my clothing. And then put some dummy film in the camera bag so that if they want to look at my stuff, all my camera bag, they're going to find all this other film and they're going to confiscate it and probably feel that. So I kind of...
And you got into the country dressed as hidden among the fighters, right?
Right. We came within just a couple meters from some border police, but I was dressed in this sort of shalwar kameez, was kind of dirty. I had this kind of scruffy beard. I literally looked like an Afghan, especially a Nuristani, which is this one region where they look very kind of European. And I literally walked past with some other Afghans, and we walked past undetected. I had my cameras in an old kind of burlap sack thrown over my shoulder. I looked like a homeless man. And so then this kind of camaraderie started with these, I guess, 5 to 7 of these Afghans, and we were sleeping on the ground. We were foraging for food. We were getting mulberries off of trees and getting bread and milk from villagers. So I kind of got in the groove. And then after a few days, we started getting close to where the fighting was. We kept getting closer and closer and closer. And I just felt like I just wanted to actually see what was happening. I wanted to get close to the fighting. I never actually got into the combat situation, but we were very close, and I could see how civilians were being affected. I could see the wounded coming, the fighters going into the front, And it was just, it was incredible, something I'd never witnessed in my life.
It was a pivotal moment in your career, as you've mentioned, and the reporting that you did for it was central to the coverage of newspapers worldwide, including the New York Times, and I think Time magazine too, right? And it was for your work in Time that you eventually went on to win the Robert Capa Gold Medal Award for reporting, which I think was the first major award of your career. How were you able to take such effective photographs of conflict under these circumstances? How did you figure out how to cover it?
Well, I was with them, living with them. We were together all the time. And I had the, you know, the presence of mind to photograph everything I saw. And it just was this incredible, dramatic time at right at the beginning of this Afghan conflict. I mean, you know, we're deep into it decades now, but this was, it was about a year, this sort of uprising was about a year, and it was still this grassroots, it was farmers, it was shepherds, it was these mountain men who had taken up arms. They were literally at the beginning just fighting for their village.
Skipping ahead a little to 1984, as you mentioned, your 1979 trip to Afghanistan was really where your career took off. And from there, you began getting commissions sent places by magazines. National Geographic was going through a bit of a golden era at the time, I understand, in terms of its, particularly its photographic coverage of far-flung regions. And they sent you to Afghanistan to cover the refugee camps there. And it was on this trip that you would take your most well-known photo. But when you initially received the commission, what was your understanding of what you were being sent out there to photograph? Give me a little bit of the political context and why the magazine was interested in it.
Well, in 1984, there were like 3 million Afghan refugees living in Pakistan. There was probably another million in Iran and some in Central Asia. So this, I'd already been to Afghanistan at that time, maybe 10 times. So I knew very well the border situation. I'd been to many of these camps. So this was the In 1980, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, this was like the biggest story of that at that time. The Olympics, you know, the U.S. pulled out of the Olympics. It was this big, huge international story. So I actually wrote a proposal to go in and photograph what's happening along the border, all these refugee camps, the hundreds of refugee camps, and fighters going in, the stream of fighters going into Afghanistan from Pakistan, being trained in Pakistan, being funded in Pakistan, and then going into fight. So I wanted to document all that. And in the middle of that story, I was in a refugee camp just outside of Peshawar. I was actually heading back to my hotel. I thought, okay, it's about 11 o'clock in the morning, go back. And I just walked past this school. It was in a tent. And I heard these voices, these girls reciting something. I thought, okay, well, maybe on my way back, I'll just stop in and check this out. So I go into the tent, and there's all these girls and the teacher. And before I even asked permission from the teacher if I could photograph, I saw this one little girl with this incredible expression, this face, these incredible eyes. And I was like taken aback. And then I thought, okay, well, I asked the teacher, I said, I'm here, here's my permission, here's my letter of permission. Can I photograph in your classroom? She has said, of course. And she told the students that the world needs to know about what's happening, and it's important for this man to photograph us, tell the story. But what I had my mind on the whole time was this one girl, this one little girl. So I went around the class and I made some pictures of some of the other students to try and get them to relax. I eventually came to Sharbat Gula, this girl with the incredible eyes, and by this time she had seen me photograph other students, so she agreed. The first shot of her, I photographed her, was she had her hands up to her face, and she was kind of covering her mouth and her nose. And the teacher said, no, it's important to let this man photograph you, because the world needs to know this story. So she dropped her hands, and this incredible light was coming in from the outside. It was one of these situations where all the stars perfectly aligned for this picture. The light was right. She had this incredible expression. She had this shawl, which was sort of dirty and tattered. The background was perfect. And I literally had to do nothing except just sit there on the floor and point my lens at her and have her look into my camera. And that's all I needed to do. Maybe a minute, maybe 2 minutes. She got up. She decided, okay, well, you know, she didn't understand anything about portrait session. She got up and she left. And that was my opportunity with her. But in that 2 or 3 minutes, I got this picture. Now, remember, this was in the age of film. It's this kind of dark tent, beautiful light, but I'm on a tripod. And I had no clue what I really had. And then suddenly I'm being jostled and made a couple other pictures. And then it was time to basically go. As the days and weeks passed, I moved on to other things. I was there when Indira Gandhi was assassinated. So I jumped on a plane and flew to Delhi, came back to Pakistan. Then more weeks passed, get back, looking through the film, and I see 2 or 3 of these incredible pictures, this portrait of this girl. And I thought, whoa, this is amazing. I'm going through with the picture editor. The one that became the sort of the icon was my favorite. The one with her hands to her face and mouth was the picture editor's favorite choice, because he said the other picture, the one of the main portrait, is too disturbing. People aren't going to want to look at that picture on their coffee table for a month. And I thought, well, wait a minute. The whole point of this story is it's disturbing. We have 3 million people who have been displaced. Their villages have been bombed. It's a disturbing story. I mean, that's, you know, we got to tell like it is. Anyway, so we presented our edited selection to the editor-in-chief. And of course, when he saw all the pictures, he kind of leapt to his feet and said, the one that ended up on the cover, the one of her, well, that's our picture we have to put on the cover, because it's this memorable, striking, perhaps disturbing picture of this little girl with this incredible expression. And that became the cover. Cover pictures come and go. This picture ended up getting this life all of its own. It ended up on the cover of other magazines. It ended up on the cover of some books. It ended up being in exhibitions. And it started being the cover of photography books, and the kind of the lead picture to an exhibition. And this 1984, 85, and then after the Taliban, when we were in Afghanistan, then we suddenly think, well, wait a minute, what happened to that Afghan refugee girl? We don't know her name or where
she's
living.
This is much later in the
2001. So we're wondering, you know, is she still alive? What happened to her? So together with a filmmaker, we decided to go back in Afghanistan. I knew we would never find her. I said, this is impossible. This girl now is 30 years old. She's probably living deep in Afghanistan and without any communication. So I thought, okay, well, let's go through the motions. Let's go back to the school where I photographed her. Maybe, you know, but by 2001, you know, literally millions of Afghans had returned back home. She may be living days and days walk from the border. So then one thing really, like a miraculous thing happened. One man came up and said, you know, I know her brother, but I can find him, but I need to be paid to take this bus trip into Afghanistan. We thought, okay, yeah, we'll give this guy some money. We'll never see him again. So we gave him some money for the bus, and some days passed, almost forgotten about it. And then suddenly he shows up with the brother. The brother has the same eyes as Shahrbat Gula. And suddenly we got really excited, because we thought, you know, this could be real. And then he said, well, you know, my sister's like out in the car. Do you want to? So we had a female person in our crew. So the female crew member actually was the first one to meet her. And then we started to look at her as a 30-year-old woman, look at her in the photograph. And we got very excited that this was probably her.
Did she recognize herself when you showed
her
the photograph?
Yes, she did. Mm. She had never been photographed before since the picture I made of her.
Wow.
Ever.
What was her reaction to seeing the photo again after 18 years?
Well, first of all, she didn't realize her picture had been reproduced literally, I promise you, hundreds of millions of times. And for all she knew was that the magazine we were showing her, there was maybe that was the only copy. Maybe that was it, or maybe there were a few. It was only after some time when her husband and we had a very trusted translator, a very famous Pakistani journalist, started to explain to her, no, this was a cover of a magazine. It's been printed a lot. Your picture's been all over the world. You're famous. Your picture's famous. And these people have come here to find you and to help you and to actually pay you.
Because that was part of the motivation behind finding her again, is to, in some way, remunerate her.
Compensate her, absolutely.
Right.
I mean, you know, her picture had been used for promotional purposes for, you know, 17 years. So she was due some compensation for that. I mean, that was the fair thing to do. So, in fact, that's what happened. We talked to her. There was an agreement organized. So it was all done in a very amicable and very... the story went on and on and on, and we kept in touch with her. We bought her a house to live in, and in her name, which is really unheard of in that part of the world. And then the bottom fell out when, just like last year, it turned out that she had fraudulent, or it was alleged that she had fraudulent papers, and that, in fact, there was irregularities with her status as a refugee. Who knows if that's the case, but to make an example of her for other Afghan refugees, they decided to arrest her and actually put her in jail. Once this news went around the world, it became this really bad PR move for Pakistan. And so after a few days, this became really like a hot potato, and they basically just said, you know, go home. Go.
And she's okay now.
The president of Afghanistan and his wife actually presented her with a home in Kabul. So actually turned out for the best, because now she's back in her own country. She's been presented with a house to live in. Hopefully moving forward, she'll have a more quiet life.
So last year in 2016, you became subject to some controversy, particularly among photographers. And it began when an Italian photographer noticed an apparent alteration to one of your images that was on show in Italy, and he brought attention to that on his blog. And subsequently, other examples of apparent alteration of your images were brought to light. One of your initial responses cited the fact that some of your favourite photographers had approached the processing part of making a photo, the time spent in the darkroom, as an integral part of their photographic practice and their art. And you seemed to be suggesting that contemporary digital manipulation was kind of analogous to that.
Oh, it's exactly the same. You could always do that with film. I mean, you can do it easier now with a computer, but that was something that you could always do back in the days of film.
Do you think the criticism that that was leveled at you because of this, do you think it was fair?
I think people have a view of my photography and other person's photography, and you know, there's people that are going to criticize you and people that love what you do. So I think in the end, you just have to be true to yourself. You go out and go to the places that interest you, that inspire you, and do the kind of work that gives your life meaning and fulfillment. I'm going to the Galapagos Islands soon. I'm going to New Guinea. I'm going to places that I haven't been in the past. And I want to just get the most out of this life that I can. And that's, I can't worry about anything other than me and my family. If somebody doesn't like my work for this reason or that work, this reason or that reason, you know, that's okay. I've gotten enough people have respected my work and admired what I do, so that's fine. I'm okay with where we stand now.
Final question: if you could pick just one of your pictures to be discovered by anthropologists in 3,000 years' time, after all other evidence of your existence has been destroyed, which one would it be and why?
I would say that possibly the body of work which has been the most rewarding was the Monsoon, because it's this human drama. It's a case where it says life and death.
This was in India.
India, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, went to the Philippines. I was in China, Burma. I think it's full of drama, and it's unpredictable. It can be, you have these incredible floods, droughts, and people sometimes are living on a thread. And it's an incredible human story.
And you think it will still tell an engaging story in 3,000 years' time?
Yeah, I think that man's struggle to survive and the, you know, the will to live is something which is universal and timeless.
Great. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Big Interview was produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Cassie Galpin. I'm Henry Rhys-Sheridan. Thank you for listening.